Hello and welcome to News Club, the place where we ask got news. Also, more importantly, a place where we talk about the news and what to do about it. And with me today, I've got Debs Grayson and Tom Chivers from various establishments that you should know about and are super cool, like Media Reform Coalition and Opus Independence. But more importantly, they're just cool people who know stuff. A lot more stuff than I do. And today we're going to be talking about the news and what to do about it. So let's dive straight in. And Debs, today, what are we talking about? You are our activism correspondent and talking very much about how we change things. What do we need to change and in what way this week?
Well, I wanted to talk this week about energy and our energy systems. There was a story that was in a lot of the mainstream news this week about GB Energy, Great British Energy, which is one of the kind of Labour flagship policies, was to set up this organisation. And they made a whole load of big claims about it bringing down energy bills and, you know, kickstarting a Green New Deal or whatever. But as usual with these things, they've not nearly given it enough money. And the story this week was, oh, GB Energy will create 1,000 jobs in the next 20 years, which is obviously rubbish. I mean, they were kind of saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to bring in loads of investment. And so there'll be all of these other jobs in the supply chain. But, you know, there are other calculations which have said if they actually capitalised it properly, like gave it, say, £70 billion, then that could be the foundation of, say, like over a million green jobs. So it's this kind of usual pattern of doing things in this really half-hearted way. And then I just wanted to talk about like a campaign and an activist group who are doing things on the energy system in like a different way. So one is an organization called Power for People. I actually had a chat with someone from that the other week. And they're trying to pass a piece of legislation which would mean that people can do peer-to-peer selling when they're generating electricity. So at the moment, if you've got solar panels on your roof generating electricity, you either have to use it in your house or sell it to the grid. What you can't do is sell it to your neighbour. Power for People have been trying to get, they were trying to get this amendment in a previous piece of legislation, and it was just massively blocked by the energy companies, including Octopus Energy, who are presenting themselves as like supporting community initiatives and stuff. But actually, this piece of enabling infrastructure that would decenter the big energy companies was something that they really pushed against. So anyway, Power for People are now trying to get... There's going to be a Great British Energy Bill, and they're trying to get, again, this like piece of this amendment in it, this piece of legislation that would mean that you could sell to your neighbours, which is kind of an obvious thing about how that would really change the community energy space. It would mean that, you could buy solar panels with everyone on your street, and then you could share electricity with each other. You could gift electricity to each other. You could have this kind of level of autonomy as a group. And it would also be something that would really benefit in terms of reducing resistance to onshore wind farms or whatever. At the moment, one of the problems is that you can't actually say we're going to sell to the local community and they're going to get a lower price. That's actually not possible because you just have to sell directly to the grid. So they're running a campaign. And if you want to get involved in that, you can go to the Power for People website and you can write to your MP. And there is a lot of cross-party support for it. It's just that the energy companies are obviously really against it. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about was, you know, when we're talking about what, you know, where are we going to find the money to put into community energy or make this stuff possible? Well, there's a very obvious place that the government could find £700 million a year or so, which is that they can stop subsidies to Drax Power Station. So Drax is a power station in Yorkshire that used to burn coal, and it now burns these wood pellets, which are imported mostly from North America. It's bad on many, many levels. Cutting down trees and burning them is bad. There's a lot of emissions. The process of making the pellets is very, very toxic as well for the local communities. But what's even worse is that this is classified as green energy. And so Drax has had over £7 billion in subsidies since it started transitioning to these wood pellets. And there's supposed to be a decision being made. We thought the decision would be made in the autumn. It still hasn't been made. So there is, again, like some quite, there's a local group called Axtrax, which are based in Yorkshire, and they're sort of supporting people campaigning around, you know, saying to Ed Miliband and saying to local MPs, you know, you need to be against renewing these subsidies. And then you've also got Reclaim the Power, which is an activist, a direct action group, which has been running for over 10 years. And last summer was trying to run a camp that was drawing attention to Drax. And there was a mass arrest before the camp could happen. And it basically impounded all the equipment, so the camp didn't take place. And they are having a meeting. They're having a national gathering in Manchester on the 22nd and 23rd of February. And that's going to be a kind of organising and strategising space. I think they still want to keep the focus on Drax. That's my understanding. But, you know, what they've been trying to do over this last decade is really draw together like these different themes of, you know, the ways that people are disempowered in terms of their politics, the way they're disempowered in terms of their relationship to the energy system, the way they're disempowered in terms of being able to tackle climate change, and kind of trying to reclaim that power for people together to be able to make decisions about things like, do I want my tax money being spent on cutting down trees in Louisiana and giving people cancer over there and then putting loads of carbon into the atmosphere? Or do I want it to be spent on a local community energy project which could sell me some cheaper electricity and help decarbonize our whole energy system? So, yeah, those are kind of two different routes of action of people really trying to think about how the energy system could be different.
That's kind of amazing, isn't it, that people are doing that? And my immediate reflection is getting the existing legacy news media to talk about this is like trying to get a five-year-old to eat their broccoli. Like, it's just an absolute nightmare. And yet, you know, we've mentioned it before, we're going to keep mentioning it, you know, news kind of happens to you. It's not something that it informs you of a bad thing and then leaves it like a bad smell. And here's some news that you could get that would be like, these are the discussions we should be having. Because it might be that we decide, well, actually, you could do better than that scheme or something like that. But at least we'd be talking about like solutions, not like just problems. Problems usually that other people are causing the same people. And then sort of being left holding the bag kind of thing. Are there ways that like people can get involved to support these things, you know, both in like, we'll try and include, I guess, some links in the newsletter, but like, you know, more like if you're trying to build communication systems or groups or things like that to support initiatives like this, how do you think you go about it?
Well, I mean, as it happens, I was involved a bit in the Reclaim the Power camp that never happened, and I was doing a bit on comms, and you know, we were really trying to build our strategy not around, you know, like, we have to engage with mainstream media in some ways because they'll probably write about us, so we have to have a strategy for how to respond, but being much more like the story itself is actually, like you're saying, it's not just that it's asking them to eat their broccoli. It's actually, it goes against a whole set of the structures of the ways that they think about stories. So even the fact that, like, it's a transnational story. It's a story about, in the case of Drax, it's a story about how trees are being cut down in one place and affecting communities there and driving environmental racism there. And then we are connected to it. Literally, that could be the power that is powering the lights in my room right now. And yet it's, you know, to the way that The Guardian has covered it, for example, they have covered the story under their US news desk, but they haven't covered it in the same way. They weren't like linking it in the same way with their, they have done better, to be fair, in the last 6 months, but there's a way that things are like artificially separated from each other when in reality they're not. And that's why I think trying to go through more like the, you know, we did get some good coverage from the sort of alternative independent news that was able to tell a more holistic story and connect things up and not just be like, that's not my beat, so that bit of the story is irrelevant to me.
Yeah, because that's one of the devastating things, that the news either see it as distant or paint it as distant, you know, these issues. I think that's one of the big problems that's been had with climate change, right? Like, I think it's very easy to talk about gases and carbon. I think if I hear another thing about fucking carbon, pardon my French, if I hear another thing about carbon dioxide again, I might, you know, smash my head against the wall. Not because it's not incredibly important, but that, you know, gases in the air is possibly the most indefinable, distant thing to the human mind that you could come up with. They're literally invisible. And they have not, and we sort of emotionally connect with humans. Whereas, like a story like this, I don't think is distant, right? Like, it feels very human. It is, as you say, it's people in Louisiana, it's people here, it's the lights in your room, and the way that you're telling it, you know, feels very close. As you say, it's not just broccoli. I mean, it's partially the way that they approach things, and they're like, oh, stories need to be exciting. But it's also that institutionally, like, you know, most of them are funded by fossil fuel companies. Their owners and proprietors are, and you know, completely opposed to, you know, making any change, and they are very much in hock to fossil fuel companies in the same way that, like, tobacco companies had a control over them. And I saw a great report from DSmog detailing, DSmog, a great independent outlet, you know, talking about how you know, they're using the, you know, the tobacco company route to protect their profits by, like, encouraging denialism and then giving up on certain areas, but then spreading disinformation in others and just funding massive amounts of disinformation. And then in that soup, it's not just that no one covers this story or covers it well, it's that in this sort of, like, polluted ecosystem, the story can't break through. So, like, I guess it's outside of messaging, you know, something that I'd want to encourage people to do is start joining a little group. We're going to publish these soon, you know, like, how to set up your own little news club, just where you chat about news with the mates, like real news, really important stuff. And I think by chatting about important stuff, you'll also start thinking about, like, what you can do about it. And it might be, as I say, we include, like, letters or actions or groups you can support, or it's that you can share it yourselves and get people talking about something that forces decision makers to care about it more than they want to. You know, that's something that I definitely suggest. So are there any, like, big gatherings coming up or like elements to that movement that we should kind of, like, know about that's on the horizon?
Well, I mean, in terms of the broader environmental movement, there's actually an Earth First gathering happening this weekend in Sheffield. And there's also the Earth First Winter Moot, which is happening, I think, the following weekend in Nottingham. And then there's the Reclaim the Power gathering, which is the 22nd, 23rd of February. So there's quite a lot of gatherings which are happening. I guess everyone's in that, like, oh, it's nearly the end of winter and we need to plan what we're doing in the summer when it's more pleasant to be outside. I mean, with Reclaim the Power, they're still fundraising for replacing a whole lot of equipment that was seized by the police. So if you want to donate to that fundraiser, that's on the website. You can just go to reclaimthepower.org.
There's tons of different things to get involved in. If you can get involved in person, going along to a gathering sometimes can feel a bit intimidating, but it's actually, like, I think it's where we really feel like we can make a difference. Like, when you're spending time with wonderful people who are trying to make a difference, trying to make a change, that's actually when you feel most alive and most invigorated, I think, as a human, not just about topics and politics that you want to change, but I think as a person, when you come together with other great people, that's fantastic. But donating, just following Reclaim the Power on social media, things like that, these are all actually significant and useful. And also, and I'll mention it a few times, it's surprising how useful writing to your MP actually is. And they're all quite worried about a bunch of things at the moment. And putting things on their agenda is actually kind of useful. Someone reads them, they all get read, and the MP might not read them, but their staffers will, and will say, oh, well, we've had, like, quite a few about this topic. And that spreads into moods within Parliament, you know, it creates a background noise. So, you know, it doesn't feel like much, but it'll take you a few minutes and fire it off. That's something else I chuck in there. Right. Okay. Well, on that note, Tom, you're going to entertain us with something I think really uplifting right now. What's going on in your world, and what should we be talking about?
Well, I should say that here at News Club Towers, in our very expensive corporate offices, we have a very, very large library with room for many, many thousands of books and pieces of reading. But it's empty currently, so I'd like to enter into the News Club library our first piece of a news reading series document. And where better to start than with David Mitchell's article in The Observer from this past Sunday on Gen Z not appreciating how well democracy works. I think the problem with some podcasts when they do reading series, there's a tendency to kind of read out the articles in a very smarmy, sarcastic tone of voice, which, you know, can be very, very fun, but isn't always fair on the person who wrote the article. In this case, I think it's completely fair, because that is David Mitchell's basic tone of voice, is to be incredibly smarmy and condescending.
Yeah.
And show utter contempt for the people he's trying to convince. So this is an article titled, "Here's a Shocking Finding, Gen Z, Democracy Isn't Perfect." And it comes off the back of a poll that Channel 4, or a polling research that Channel 4 conducted recently and have just published about the attitudes of Generation Z to politics, society, the economy, their own place in the world, etc. So Gen Z, these are the 13 to 27-year-olds, which is the kind of bracket that Channel 4 is using here. And the subtitle to David Mitchell's brilliant article is, "According to a new poll, half of our 13 to 27-year-olds can't see the point of all those time-wasting elections and parliaments. Why do they not know that authoritarianism is worse?" And the poll itself found that 52% of Gen Zers, Gen Zers, however you want to call them, say the UK would be better if a strong leader was in charge who does not have to bother with parliament or elections. With which David Mitchell responds to by saying, yes, this is half of, nearly just over half of that generation saying screw democracy. First of all, I want to say that same poll also found that 40% of 45 to 65-year-olds say the same thing. David Mitchell's 50, so he hasn't directed any of his ire about lack of faith in democracy in people of his own age. Is first of all, no, he's decided to dedicate an entire article in The Observer to young people, and how dare they not respect the institutions that have completely fucked them over. Just to read the kind of opening bit from it, and I won't read too much, but he sort of starts off by saying, "The coming generation can't see the point of all those time-wasting elections and parliaments. They want neither the reality nor the pretense of being involved." Well, that might be because, under our current totally failed and corrupt democratic system, the reality of involvement is all pretense,
yeah.
Right? There is no actual genuine sense in which anybody, whether it's a young person or an older person, actually has any real democratic participation in the system ahead of them. You get a choice once every 5 years. For most of the people in the country, your choice doesn't matter, because the first-past-the-post electoral system completely flattens your voting power into something irrelevant. And then everything that happens subsequently is just directed at you, and you've got no say or accountability how that goes, except for how the mainstream media decide to interpret your views and your interests into something that is a complete sort of partial representation of what you actually believe. David Mitchell then goes on to say, in a typical sort of smarmy, disgusting, dismissive way that lots of older people in the media tend to talk about young people, "In a sense, these Gen Zers have brilliantly proved their own argument against democracy. If they are so wrong-headed, maybe it is better not to consult them. In a way, they're making a very clever satirical point, except they're obviously fucking morons." Now, this must be from the front cover of How to Win Friends and Influence People, if David Mitchell is actually trying to convince these young people who don't feel a stake in democracy, actually, you're just wrong and stupid and we shouldn't listen to you, which by and large has been the approach of democratic politics for most of the last 30 years. This is to see that young people don't find a stake or a meaning in politics, largely because at that point in their life, there aren't that many things that really appear to affect them. And so mainstream politicians have just ignored them and not include them within the democratic process. So, you know, this classic, this is an authoritarian argument, right? This is to say, if you don't buy into the system, we won't listen to you and we'll exclude you from the process. But it's being presented as like, oh, me, very clever, very wise David Mitchell, understanding that actually, you know, if only young people weren't so fucking stupid and really appreciated all the wonderful things that democracy is doing for them, maybe we'd actually be bothered to listen to their concerns.
I mean, I think that tone highly exemplifies the tone of pro-Remainers during the Brexit referendum. And it's astonishing for two reasons. Like it's sort of repugnant in its superciliousness, right? Like in its like complete dismissal of like half or more than half of the population, or almost everyone really. Like, you know, you're just like, that's a kind of morally repugnant elitist position to take that's kind of like gross and smarmy and yeah. off-putting. But secondly, it's hypocritical's not quite the right word. It's so sort of counterproductive for people who think that they're smarter than other people. If you think that you're smarter than other people and that, for instance, other people don't deserve to vote, but you'd like them to maintain this pretense so that you can have the democracy that's so wonderful, probably the way to win the round is not by calling them all thick, essentially. Like, people do not respond well to being called thick. Like, yeah. And being called thick in one and many numbers away, or it being intimated that you're thick or that you're undeserving of, you know, a stake
yeah,
in the
absolutely.
Process.
Yeah, absolutely. The undeserving thing is great because it's basically proving the point that, like, this system isn't for you. If that's the way you think, then maybe you shouldn't be involved. Sit on the sidelines, let things happen to you. Here's a pat on the head. Thanks for trying. But, you know, you're too dumb to understand it. So just sit it out and let the adults decide for you.
Yeah. And then they wonder why they lose. Like, you know, in the rare occasions that people get a democratic choice, like the Brexit referendum, where that is, for all its flaws, a very clear, like, that's a plebiscite. That's everyone gets to vote in something meaningful and actually has a choice. And a lot of people said, do you know what, David? Sod off. Like, I think people viscerally dislike those people. They hate Blair, Cameron, Brown, not Brown less so, but Blair, Cameron, Osborne types. They hate the supercilious David Mitchell, Guardian writing, finger wagging types because of the way that they treat the majority of the population, which is like that they're less than, that they're somehow subhuman.
If you would believe me, it gets worse, because in the middle part of the article, I think what David Mitchell does is actually reveal his hand of what he thinks democracy is, in that he doesn't think it's an actual functional system in which people play a part and have power over the decisions around them. Democracy is like a brand that you sort of subscribe to and believe in, and it has actually no relationship with the things that happen in society and politics that affect your daily life. So he kind of seizes on this idea of, like, in particular young people seeming to express a love for authoritarianism, which is, yeah, a problem if there are lots of young people saying, I would prefer a strong leader over consensual decision-making. But, like, as the poll itself, as the Channel 4 work itself shows and has been the case throughout human history, that is just generally a problem of what happens when democratic systems don't work democratically, and when actually a lot of the power and the influence gets sort of concentrated amongst an elite group of interests who can sort of steer and cajole and corrupt democratic systems to work in their favour. But he talks about how a lot of the global population doesn't live in functional democracies, but even a lot of those states sort of give a pretense of being democratic. And he says, those lying dictators are still, like I was, taking it as a given that everyone thinks democracy is the fairest system of government. You can withhold people's right to self-determination, but you can't persuade them not to want it. If it's not a democracy, at least it's got to pretend it is. So this is where he's basically saying, like, as long as you can pretend to be a democracy, as long as you can have all the trappings and the rituals, whether that's in Uzbekistan or Hungary or even in the UK, as long as you've got the pretenses of it, you've done the important bit, which is to protect, to label yourself a democracy without necessarily being democratic. What he misses throughout this entire article, and that's my point about him being more obsessed with the branding of a democracy than the practice, is that nowhere in this article does he actually address the material conditions that Gen Zers have faced throughout their life. And if you just take the last, you know, 15, 20 years, which would be sort of the median of people who are in that age bracket. Like, these are things that actually the Channel 4 survey brought up to say, why do they feel like this? Why do Gen Zers feel so detached from democratic systems? A declining happiness and sense of purpose. They are more, this generation is more concerned about their mental well-being, their houses, jobs, freedom and safety than older generations. These are things that are directly, you know, the prime of their concerns, and it's not being addressed by the democratic system, and older people don't care about them as much as they do. 30% of this generation say they've changed their mind on who they would vote for over the course of the last year. Given that Gen Z, in terms of Labour's popular support at the last election, they had the highest level of support from 18 to 13-year-olds, is it any surprise that that generation within the last year has decided, actually, I might change my vote as a result of what I've seen over the last year from the political system? This generation is apparently more so than other generations interested in a winner-takes-it-all mentality, a zero-sum mentality that is basically reflected in the economy around them, right? They see the world around them and they see that actually there is no stake in kind of cooperative, collaborative organisation. If you want to get ahead in life, it has to be on the back of someone else suffering. What David Mitchell also doesn't talk about, the privatisation and total collapse of the social compact over the last 20 years, a financial crash built on criminal corruption and greed for which all of the costs were paid by the public and all of the gains were then privatised back to the people who cause it. Illegal wars justified by lies in a completely kind of contemptuous media environment where any opposition to those wars was contemned as anti-Britishness and hateful rhetoric. A pandemic that completely shut down this generation's lives at the exact moment where they are meant to be the most youthful and free and exciting, responsibility-free years, which were instead turned into a moment where they, more than any other generation, had to bear the costs of keeping society running and keeping everybody safe. There's been elections throughout their lifetime that have been won by whoever lied the most, and all of the interests have been forwarded towards people like David Mitchell rather than younger generations. None of this comes up in David Mitchell's argument. He just looks at the branding of democracy rather than why is it that young people feel this way.
Debs, though, are you into the branding?
Well, I was listening to an interesting YouTuber the other week who was doing a critique of that political compass, test that you can do that's supposed to rate you according to like how authoritarian or liberal you are, how left or right you are. And she was making this point that, one of the features of being kind of a liberal or having a liberal ideology is that you think that ideology is just about the ideas that you have. But ideology also has to be about the strategies and the tactics and the things that you think are legitimate for getting to your ideal society. And this is really indicative, him saying like the thing that matters more is that you have some general idea about that democracy is good than that you are actually willing to take any of the steps that are necessary. For example, in our current moment, you have to be standing up to corporate power and pushing back against the corporate capture of the state. Otherwise, there is no democracy. And yet, presumably, David Mitchell thinks that, even Just Stop Oil people walking slowly in the road is like an incredible affront to democracy. Mm. He probably thinks that's like completely illegitimate.
It's not the proper channels. That's not how you do things.
Yeah. And I think there's also something about, he's a comedian of a certain age. And he is, I think, just a bit pissy that young people don't find him funny. And we see this across a bunch of people who also, I've been deeply disappointed with Armando Iannucci in the last sort of 8 years. He really is exactly what you were saying, really throwing himself into that Remain camp. I thought that Armando Iannucci's political work, like his political satire, the early years of The Thick of It and stuff, I was so into that when I was a younger person. And then actually, he seemed to have some quite incisive and countercultural politics. And then it turns out that actually he's just a complete boring centrist who, again, is constantly drawing the line of what is legitimate so that it excludes the very people who are actually trying to defend the principles and ideas that he says that he believes in.
He's like the news media insofar as he's really interested in palace intrigue, in characters within the politics and power is about this small coterie of the king and his courtiers kind of thing that you talk about, whether that's the death of Stalin or the thick of it. The comedy is from finding the humanity in these amazing, all-powerful people, but don't be confused about it. They're the ones that make the decisions, and everyone else is sort of an unwashed mass in the background of his stories. I found his satire and his comedy incredibly funny. I love it. Anything laden with swear words really does it for me. But it's like Have I Got News for You? you know, these are not these are not exploring interesting ideas. If anything, they're sort of legitimizing terrible people. Obviously, Boris Johnson's kind of like a classic example, but like it's each week like gently mocking like the Prince Charles for what he's wearing or something slightly silly he said, you know, isn't the same as like, you know, satirizing stealing billions of pounds through fake contracts or, you know, dirty handshakes. Now, there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of that, but it's very, very rare in Have I Got News For You, and it's non-existent in Armando Iannucci.
But you're right, because as well, that focus on the soap opera of politics, it means that the stakes are fundamentally low. The stakes are the personal reputations and the, you know, the relationships and, you know, are you going to stay in your position as minister or not? They're not the real stakes, which is, you know, massive austerity cuts, people, you know, dying because their benefits have been stopped. Like all of that, the real stakes are just kind of excluded from the picture. And I wonder as well with David Mitchell, particularly, that there's something about like the zeitgeist having genuinely moved on in certain respects. And in some ways, that being, I would say, in a positive direction of like, I think there is a much lower tolerance and space for a certain kind of white male elitism that means that he's kind of dated. In other senses, there's the other piece of it, which is that, you know, what there is space for is the Nigel Farage version of that white male elitism, where it's more kind of hidden or suppressed or coded. But yeah, there's
chummy,
almost a way.
Bit more fun, isn't it? With
yeah,
Farage.
Exactly. Like they actually want people to have a sense of humour. And what we've discovered very clearly with someone like David Mitchell is that he's a comedian, but he's got absolutely no sense of humour whatsoever. I mean, it's just actually really sad that the way that he can make himself relevant is to just like shit on young people in The Observer.
Yeah. I don't think he's making himself relevant, though, is he? Like, I didn't expect this, by the way, to be ragging on David Mitchell for half an hour. But I'm enjoying it.
Debs has nailed something really crucial there, which I think is that everybody across society, whether they worked it out 20 years ago or they're just working it out now, is recognising that basically nothing's working. Everything about the system we have now is actively disempowering them and something's got to give. I think the problem for the cast of people like David Mitchell is that their only response to it is what their response has always been of that generation of alternative comedians, which is to smarm and to sort of politely mock and use terms like fuck waffle and wank puffin and all these sort of fatuous, deeply unfunny, infantilizing bullshit terms that have sort of typified their comedy. But they were at the time, you know, the alternative comedy was like an evolution on club comedy, right? Of the 70s, which was Bernard Manning, Jim Davidson, deeply racist, deeply sexist, homophobic, but always still very deferential to like elites and power and seeing that broadly the structure of British society was fine as long as you were waving a flag and as long as you know, saluted the Queen and stood up for the national anthem, everything was fine. Alternative comedy came in and sort of did an opposite of that, which was very much to berate and mock and smarm at those institutions, which is where things like The Thick of It have come from, where it's like, oh, as long as you can just target the individual and expose their kind of foibles and their failures and their neuroses, then that's where the comedy comes from, is actually pointing out that those in power are just as feckless as everybody else. But then there's now this moment where they've got to recognise that even that alone is not enough, which is ironically where David Mitchell finishes the article, and I promise this is the last bit I'll read. Okay. This is my public service to you, as I've read the article so you don't have to. He sort of talks about, okay, well, is it maybe that young people have noticed that, you know, democracy is flawed and that it is failing? And he summarises by saying, well, let's make it shorter for them. Nobody's perfect. Blah, blah, blah. Cowardly self-politicians make mistakes, etc., etc. But, and this is where he ends, but the advantage that democracy gives us and its sumptuous compensation for the problems it causes is the power to sack them, is the power to sack people in power. I mean, great. Look how well that's worked out. We've replaced one kind of government of identikit, corrupt, feckless politicians with another government of identikit, corrupt, feckless politicians, unaccountable billionaire donors, media personalities, dangerously nefarious interest groups and corporate lobbyists. I mean, just look, the people who lost the election, like Jonathan Ashworth, we can't get rid of them. They're stuck around. This idea that, like, oh, as long as you vote people out, then you can have... We can't vote them out. They stick around because they're all part of this same constantly recirculating class of interested or self-interested elites and, you know, backhanded corporate interests and media chumminess. So he's exposed in his own article the reason why a lot of people, and particularly why the generation that's going to matter most for facing a lot of these crises, Generation Z, who will be the ones that will sort of swing where a lot of these decisions go over the next 20 years, maybe why they feel that this system isn't working, because even the basic kind of branding power of democracy, the power to change who represents you, isn't working. Forget all of the stuff that's like materially making all of these young people's lives worse. The basic power that they're meant to have and put faith in, and the only way they can represent themselves, also isn't working because it doesn't give them a way to meaningfully change the people who are making decisions on their behalf.
I'm going to bring you in, Debs, for some thoughts on that and everything else. I would say that you talk about 20, 30 years. We're talking really 45 years. We're talking Thatcher onwards,
sure.
Right? Like, and millennials are in a similar position in terms of materially and socially completely divorced from any belief in the system in a way that our Gen X and boomers really aren't. And so it is worth noting those things. But I was half expecting you to say wank puffing in amongst that rant. So, you know, well done on not doing that. Debs, just finalising on comedy, and then I want to actually just quickly talk about democracy before talking that. Like, because you were sort of ragging on his career, and there is an interesting thing that the stalwarts of British comedy now are like these last remaining shows like Taskmaster and Would I Lie to You, and David Mitchell's on Would I Lie to You, which is like a global phenomenon, which is of, like, you know, is whimsical and is a kind of comedy that I think really the British exemplify and do the best, and I'd like to celebrate. But also comedy during that radical, that alternative era of the 80s produced Red Dwarf, which is a story about, like, imagine if sci-fi was about the cleaner, you know, who cleaned chicken soup machines rather than, like, you know, the hero captains, you know, in Star Trek, you know, or like The Young Ones, which always had like a sort of anarchist monologue in the middle, or like Bottom, which is like two no-hopers just beating the crap out of each other and staring at the star. Like, you know, that what I think is missed, I love the whimsy, but I'm missing like that sense of sort of working class comedy that you saw in things like People Just Do Nothing and This Country. You know, you get these moments, but like our panel shows are, which are our biggest export, are like this kind of whimsy that sort of, I think by its nature, encourages you to not tackle anything meaningful with comedy. You know,
well, it also, you know, it speaks culturally to this trend of producing British TV for a global audience, exactly what you're saying, that you're selling it, which means that you actually don't want it to be particularly specific. If they are going to make jokes about politics or politicians, they need to be of a very kind of general, you know, taking the piss out of somebody with power, wearing stupid clothes, like you say. They need to be relatable to people that don't actually know what the political environment or the political stakes are. So yeah, I think that's been a huge trend, and you know, you can see with something like Channel 4, there's these like little vestiges of that kind of TV show making. For example, what was that show, We Are Lady Parts? Like, that's a very like Channel 4 show about like four Muslim women in a punk band. That's the kind of thing that they would have made in the 80s. But that's a real minority of what they make now. And most of what they make is this stuff which has its eye on selling to a global English-speaking audience. And there's something, you know, when we're talking about comedy and its ability to really, like, get at the heart of things, like, it has to be specific. It has to be allowed to to get in, like, under the skin of, like, how particular groups of people relate to each other, and also to be able to say things that matter and talk about things that matter. And so, yeah, there's this, exactly what you're talking about, the kind of the culture of whimsy. I mean, it's interesting that we've spent all this time talking about this article. In lots of ways, the thing that's more significant is the fact that The Observer feel like it's in their interest to publish this thing, because from everything that you've said, Chivers, like, David Mitchell could have just said to ChatGPT, write me an article in the style of David Mitchell based on this poll. But the question is, why does The Observer think that this is worth their space, worth their airtime, worth printing?
Well, I want to finish on this note before moving on to the next thing, which is that, you know, I remember when the invasion of Ukraine began and anarchists within Ukraine were pretty divided on, you know, fighting for Ukraine when, you know, a large section of a fighting force was openly Nazi. You know, and there were elements of the establishment of that. But ultimately, the anarchists put out a statement saying, I'd rather fight for an imperfect republic than live under a perfect dictatorship. And I think whilst David Mitchell, for all the reasons we've explained, has really explained that concept in the worst possible way, if there was anything to guarantee that people would turn off from an imperfect republic and embrace a perfect dictatorship, then it's that kind of article, which again is what astonishes me about these people who think that they're smart. They're so terrible at persuasion in every level. You know, they only indulge superciliousness and an in-crowd that likes to feel better than others. Regardless of all of that, there is a truth to that, right? Like, if we get rid of even the pretense of democratic norms, of probity in public life, if we give up the pretense that that's important, then how are we even supposed to actually build a proper democracy? Like, how are we supposed to build a more engaged one? If obviously the results that an imperfect, you know, barely functioning democracy has given have been so bad that you would embrace something else. But it's in complete rejection of it, you end up potentially embracing authoritarianism. And I do agree with him there. I think that's a problem. I do think that in lieu of saying, actually, what we need to do is come together and be able to make more decisions together. Mm. And by the way, if we get them wrong, at least we own them together.
Yeah.
You know, like, we take responsibility for those. I think we need to create a culture, by the way, where people who voted for Brexit go, yeah, well, look, it didn't give us what we wanted, and we probably should have realised it never was going to. And that's not anyone else's fault but ours. We voted for what we got, and we got what we voted for. And sorry for the things that is fucked up. That's our fault. You know, like, yeah, that's what we should be able to do in a democracy. Without me, by the way, I'm very neutral on the Brexit debate, throwing shade at that side. They should be able to say that. And then the other side say, yeah, you were the majority. We accept the result. We're not going to try and change it. But it was a cock-up, and we did try to tell you that it was going to be a cock-up in these ways, and let's work out how to fix it. And that should be how we create a democratic culture. I was going to bring up the digital markets... I can't remember. The DMCCA. I was going to bring up an act that's about changing big tech and so forth. But actually, we had a chat before the episode a bit about Trump, just accidentally, and how... it's sort of important to not talk about Trump, but it's also important to talk about Trump. And I actually thought for the last few minutes we'd open that up, because I'll come back to in more detail this Digital Markets Act, which will enable people to, for the first time, fight back and actually, yeah, decentralize the information system in a way that just really has never been available to us. And it's really fascinating, but it's a long process and it's a little bit dense, and I need to, quite frankly, prepare a little better. So let's talk about Trump, because you don't really need to prepare to talk about Trump. He's just this orange wrecking ball. But he's more than that, isn't he? And what I'm struggling with at the moment is that British news media are talking so much about Trump. And I imagine that's the case in every country. And he's achieving now globally what he was achieving within his country in his first presidency, which is to make sure all eyes are on him. And I would like us to turn off from him because we've got things that we need to do and achieve here in this country, and we need things that need to be scrutinised. For instance, how shit GB Energy is, right? Like, this is just, you know, something we need to dig into and we need to be forcing the government on. But, Tom, you pointed out that, like, having said that, it's a way of holding a mirror to our own government. I did notice the news agents push a Labour minister for like 7 minutes to like commit to protecting Greenland if Trump invaded it. And, you know, I don't think it was fatuous, actually, because there is a possibility that the US might invade Greenland. Like, that is a real prospect. So on one hand, that is a real substantive, like, policy issue to talk about. But secondly, it holds up a mirror to, like, what are our politicians doing? Are they acting in our national interest? And our national interest is, for instance, to protect EU, European neighbours' sovereignty, our own sovereignty, or not, you know? Like, I think that's really interesting. But you mentioned a sort of different situation, Chivers, about, like, where we could hold a mirror up around Palestine.
Yeah, so we've just had this morning or over the night, whatever time it was in America, Trump meeting with Netanyahu and very openly saying the US's policy is going to be about a forced, basically, you know, ethnic cleansing of Gaza by saying that, oh, well, Israel's done such a fantastic job in completely destroying, you're turning Gaza into an apocalyptic wasteland where it's completely unlivable. All of the infrastructure has been actively targeted and destroyed by the Israeli military in the course of their war on the territories. The sort of illegal occupation and settler colonialism over both, you know, the West Bank and Gaza is going to continue apace. And Trump is very much behind it all and now actively proposing that everybody in Palestine, all Palestinians, should leave and be decamped somewhere else, which is just openly a call to literally the ethnic cleansing of the territory. There's no other way to put it. What we've seen throughout the last, what is it now, 18 months or so, or the 17 months, is basically the UK government has been quietly in support of all of this, or maybe at times openly in support of what Israel has been doing, while still holding up this pretense of saying our ultimate goal is a safe and secure Israel next to an independent and sovereign Palestine, in which Palestinian people have their own form of government and there's some kind of two-state solution. I think that has always been sort of fatuous and false and a complete lie from what the Labour Party and the previous Conservative government have been saying based on what their actual decisions have been. But now this latest step by Trump does actually pose a challenge to Starmer and the Labour government and the British establishment in, here is a leader who is actively saying the things you have not wanted to have to admit you are supporting, openly saying that the US government's policy is ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Where does Starmer go in response to this? And how does the media actually hold Starmer as the British leader to account on what our nearest and dearest ally is saying is their policy on Palestine and Gaza? Do they say, we believe in, or we pretend to believe in, these norms of international law and human rights and dignity and sovereignty of peoples all around the world, and say that, no, this is an unconscionable step by the American government. We will not support it. We will do everything we can to continue our, in brackets, totally failing policy on a safe and secure Israel and a sovereign and independent Palestine. Or, in the grand schemes of, like, where does Labour face its, you know, diplomatic and economic position over the next 5 years? Does it want to go with a sort of distributed and dispersed economic model of many different trade deals, lots of reliance on Europe? Or does it completely cuddle up to America as the new rising isolationist economic and military power under Trump?
Yeah, I was listening to, on Navarra Media, they were re-watching Love Actually and talking about that. And obviously one of the themes in Love Actually from 2003 is the special relationship between the UK and the US, with Hugh Grant as the sort of Blair-like prime minister, who does, in that film, stand up to the US president in the way that obviously Tony Blair absolutely did not. And it's kind of interesting to me, this culturally where that sits now. Like, I think there is generally a much more critical sense that we shouldn't just be aligned with the US. Also, we've kind of been out of sync with them. Like, I think there was that moment in 2016 when Brexit happened and Trump was elected, when there was this sense that similar forces were on the rise and moving in both countries. But actually, you know, Boris Johnson won a big majority at the end of 2019, and then Biden won less than a year later. And then we've just had Keir Starmer come in and Trump has won again. Like, we're actually, in terms of like this dynamic of the kind of the sensibles being in power, or like the complete wild card who constantly says the quiet part out loud being in power, like, we've been out of sync since 2020. And I think it does mean that it makes it even more jarring and ridiculous that the British media are so unable to, I don't know, talk about this thing in its own terms and talk about it, like you're saying, in terms of the stakes. What are the outcomes of this, rather than just talking about it in terms of the personalities, you know, who's getting on with who's falling out with who, what's the soap opera saying, rather than being like, but if Trump invades Greenland, like, that's actually a real material thing. If he supports the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, that's not just like you know, a maneuver and a power play between him and Netanyahu. That is like a material reality for millions of people. It just kind of exposes the general unseriousness of a lot of the way that political coverage and political stories are talked about in this country.
Yeah, because there's the element of, like, clearly the British state, in the same way as the US state, is going to continue its full-blooded support for what Israel is doing in Palestine, is going to continue to support the US in all of its murderous and nefarious actions around the world, whether that's in Africa or East Asia or South America or wherever the US state is extending its military and economic power through force of arms and through violent destruction on domestic and indigenous communities. But, like, there is a sense, coming back to all this pretense of, like, how the media believes it is holding this power to account in that kind of personalized way that is always shaped around an expectation of norms and rights and beliefs, of kind of saying, you know, the quiet part, which sometimes is said out loud, is actually we don't really care about Palestinians and we don't really care about these global conflicts, but we've got to have this pretense to international law and standing up to the American state. And this is now, as you say, these material moments, these material decisions, which can't just be sort of pigeonholed as another funny thing that Trump has said that's only going to affect Americans, but another seriously dangerous and fascistic thing that Trump has said, which is actually leading to dangerous and murderous actions that are happening in the real world, in which we, the British state, the British nation, are playing a part and might want to have something to say about it.
There's a point you made earlier about, like, their continuance to not focus on the material realities. I think that is a feature rather than a bug. In fact, you know, I think Michelle Wolf did this correspondence dinner in the US in Trump's first term, where she said, I think you guys love Trump. I think you pretend to hate him, but I think you love him, because he knows his ratings. Right. And they know his ratings. They're talking about him because his ratings. And there's no way that they, again, for all the reasons, because of who they're owned and who they're funded by and so forth, that they would talk about the material consequences of politicians' actions anyways. But in particular with Trump, his ratings. By the way, all those journalists took such offense, they tried to make out that she was like a racist afterwards or something, you know, she was anti-feminist, because the thing journalists hate the most is being told accurately that they are, you know, sycophants and, you know, scribes who replicate and suck up to the powerful rather than hold them to account. They see themselves as holding them to account, and in no way do they do that. And I think Trump, again, is doing the quiet part out loud by forcing them to basically cover him and what he's saying, because it makes them money, it gets them views, it gets them ratings, without ever really holding his ideas to any, or what he's saying, to any standard. right? Like, or offering any real material critique of it, other than it's a bit gauche. The way that he's saying things is a bit, you know, it's a bit much. Like, he may have, in the past few weeks, broken the law on at least three occasions, apparently. Like, you know, legal experts are saying, broken constitutional law completely, right? Like, and I want to frame, I want to end by talking about, like, what people can do. By framing what might be happening in the world right now, I saw an interesting piece, and it concurs with a lot of research I've been doing around geopolitics and stuff like that, which is that America's position, and this was true under Biden, it's been true since Trump and even maybe a bit of Obama, is actually a retreat from its global empire. Cutting things like US aid, which whilst it may be sort of motivated in some quarters by just being mean-spirited and unpleasant about charity, is in reality in the power establishment saying we're unwilling to pay for the maintenance of dictatorships and so forth, because that's what aid is really used for, particularly military aid, is to maintain a global empire. We're not interested in Africa. We're certainly not interested in the Middle East and the Near East, and we're not interested in Europe. And Trump's moves that are genocidal, or as you say, ethnic cleansing, by other names, in places like Palestine and what will happen in Ukraine, is to affect American withdrawals as quickly as possible from these spheres. Now, that's an analysis. I'm not saying it's entirely correct one, but it seems to be both his inclination and his politics, but also that of many powerful people within the foreign policy establishment in the US. And for them to focus on their sphere of influence in the upcoming, basically, climate crisis that's going to happen, where you just need to get the resources. That's why you need Greenland and Canada, and you invade a bit of Mexico, and you look after your backyard, and you basically, and for a while, whilst you're trying to shut down China, you maintain your alliances in East Asia. But again, they've got a long-term plan to retreat from those as well. But certainly Europe, he's come along and said, spend 5% on defence. And the reason I mention all of this is we're entering into a world where European countries are potentially, are basically now going to have to spend a huge proportion of their budgets on the military. And in Britain, we already do on things like nuclear weapons, and it's going to increase a lot. And that's going to have incredible impact. And Britain has got to decide whether, as you say, it's one of these three directions, whether it's try and be friends with everyone, try and be close friends with the EU, try and be close friends with the US. It's going to, like, as a nation state, that's going to be it. And in these very sort of confusing times, because it is a new type of world order, we're all going to be looking at the fireworks coming from Trump's mouth. And that's going to get in the way of us discussing how we sort out of energy systems, our food systems, how we sort out, like, how we believe in democracy, you know, and respond to people like David Mitchell. And so we need to do a few things. First off, and I'll keep repeating it, we need to break our isolation. We need to spend time together. That's something that you can do with news clubs. You can start up your own news clubs. You can approach us and say, we'd like to get people together. I don't know what to do. I'd like to start up a dancing club or a walking club or something like that. We will help you do that, right? Like, get in touch. We want to help you spend time with other people. A lot of good things will grow from that place. Secondly, I'm going to keep saying it again. Write your MPs. We have to change the mood music of what they're hearing. If they're thinking the whole discussion and pushback they're going to be getting around things is immigration, they're going to put that center of what they do and not solve any of the problems that would actually give some people belief in democracy. So we need to get them to focus on energy, on food, on, you know, on poverty, on opportunity, right? A bunch of other things. And finally, and I'll include a couple of links in the newsletter. I think there's been a couple of interesting things from both Mediasan and Owen Jones, which is about wilder messaging. And we need to encourage parties like the Greens and other spokespeople, NGOs and otherwise, to be less considered and more wild in their messaging. I think, and this is something we can discuss on a future episode, my belief is that to cut through the noise on social media platforms that are not designed to help us, with an entire establishment that is against, you know, creating change, we need to come out and go, instead of going, well, in our considered opinion, the evidence points to things that we think we should do, like, we can achieve these potential benefits to, this is wrong, this is right, this is what we need to do. And we need to shoot for the stars so that we get to the moon, right? We need to say, we want 100% wealth tax and 100% death tax. We want, full publicization of all national resources now, right? Like, and we need to keep saying that and things like that. And we need to say it, not necessarily stridently and aggressively, but like engagingly and excitedly. And I think we should be encouraging spokespeople that we engage with to engage in ways to cut through, because I think if anything else, Trump, if we learn anything from Trump, and we shouldn't learn too many bad things, it's that in this world, attention matters, and getting attention by being, very outspoken and often saying the quiet part out loud, right, is actually maybe the way forward. Thank you very much, Debs, for being with us today. Thank you very much, Chivers. It's been fantastic to have you both. And thank you guys for listening, whoever it was that was.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.